Geopolitics and Empire is joined by ex-GCHQ spook turned dissident commentator Alex Thompson. He's featured weekly over at UK Column. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Alex.
Thank you very much, Hrvoje. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Since this is your first time on, and I'm sure it's the first time some people are seeing you or hearing you, could you just briefly tell us a little bit about yourself?
I grew up in a Christian family in the UK, Scottish father and English mother, and I enjoyed a fairly elite education. I went to one of the best boarding schools in Britain, Rugby School. I've just written a piece on that for ukcolumn.org, actually, about a fairly dark theme, the suicide of my housemaster 30 years ago this month, and reflections on that. But it enabled me as an experience to get a different view of human nature than most people are able to, and a profound study of the classics. We were even given philosophy at school, a fairly rare opportunity in a British school. Then I went off to Cambridge University studying obscure dead languages. The course title was Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic. I then went off to the former Soviet Union, specifically the Republic of Georgia, for a year as a student missionary with the International Federation of Evangelical Students, IFES or IFES. The American listeners will know the term InterVarsity better. It's just the association of Christian unions across different campuses and countries. I came back from that and was recruited by GCHQ, which is Britain's sister agency to NSA. It's the Signals Intelligence Agency, so it does the electronic and communications eavesdropping. And I was there until 2009 when I came over to the Netherlands. People watching in video will see the windmill backdrop behind me. I came over to marry a Dutch woman, and I'm very happily settled here. Now, the thing that's brought me to notice is that since 2014, I've been a correspondent for UK Column News, which is, I think, fair to say, Britain's premier, maybe even only, full-service new media organisation, in that we have intellectual comment in the round. We have a news show at lunchtime British time, 3 days a week. We're known for our skeptical coverage of COVID issues, of the Ukraine war, and we tend to take the contrarian position to anything that the British government and its media establishment are saying and have done for many years. The backstory to that is that we're all a bunch of guys who were either in the British establishment or in the respectable professions. In one case, Mike Robinson, the City of London, and at a major hedge fund. And we all saw that those we worked for were amoral people who enjoyed death and mayhem while using fine sounding language. And so we know what buttons to press in order to get the right analysis with a lot of networking. That's what's brought us to public attention. I think a certain degree of, if I dare say so myself, fearlessness, that we actually call things out for what they are without, you know, shooting from shooting at random, as it were, or from below the hip. We actually take care to analyze from primary documents, especially government and official sources themselves, what is going on, whether it's health, defense, or international relations.
Yeah, and you know, a number of the UK Column is great. A number of the people that have appeared on your program have also appeared on Geopolitics and Empire. And I think UK Column contributor Patrick Henningsen, he's my virtual colleague at TNT Radio. And I think I've even made an inadvertent appearance. I recall a couple months back, my interview with Thierry Baudet blew up, and you guys were mentioning how that was on the national Dutch media, my interview with him. So that was
I fun. Remember that well, Hrvoje. Yes. Yeah, they're always doing this, and UK Column is getting a bit of the similar backlash this week. There's a guy called Dr. Matthew Sweet, who I think is a freelancer, but presents one of the BBC's podcasts. He's a culture critic and a Doctor Who specialist, believe it or not. But he very carefully tiptoeing around UK Column, he's throwing out accusations of anti-Semitism left, right and centre. No pun intended with left, yeah, right and centre, but it is literally left, right and centre at anyone who talks about jury nullification. So close associates of UK Column have made a proper focus and study of that. And he's taken against that very much, because UK Column's closest equivalent in the licensed broadcast media, GB News, which has been through the ringers recently and lost at least one of its main contributors. I fear more will probably follow of the main real dissidents. Sweet was having a pop at them. And, you know, in church circles, this would be called third degree separation. the kind of excommunication that's going on now is, well, in Christian terms, it's I won't fellowship with you because you also fellowship with people who fellowship with heretics, right? And this is Dr. Sweet's secular strategy now. You can't have these people on GB News because they have guys on who also write for websites where Zionism is mentioned.
A quick shout out to our sponsors, which you can locate via the sponsor page on geopoliticsandempire.com or whose links are included in every podcast description. I've tried privacy phones in the past, such as Silent Circle's Black Phone, which turned out to be a dud. The best and really only option so far is de-Googling your phone. Now, you can do it yourself, but I've never had the time to figure that out and simply got an above phone. They sell de-Googled phones that come with a suite of software. They also provide support and a monthly above privacy suite with many features such as a unique phone number, encryption, email, VPN, and so forth. If you're looking for a private phone, check out Above Phone. Make sure to click on the Above Phone link on geopoliticsandempire.com or via the podcast description so that we can enjoy a commission. Also, check out the Nomos Time Bank at nomos.net, which you can download in Spanish or English to your Apple or Google or de-Googled phone. Nomos allows people in your community to exchange services using time as a currency rather than fiat money. This will be one great way to survive in the coming algorithm ghetto. If you need health insurance, you can talk to my friend James Guzman of the Borderless Blog Podcast and Health Insurance. He offers free consultations. Simply schedule a time with him over at borderlesshealthinsurance.com. Finally, you can donate directly to Geopolitics and Empire, consult with me, the host, or become a member to join private monthly member Zoom calls where we shoot the breeze discussing world events.
I was going to bring this up towards the end, but since you sort of touched on it and given your experience in GCHQ and the censorship, I just have a question where, you know, there's we know about 77th Brigade and NAFO or NATO Information Operations. And I've just noticed a strange trend where I'm openly anti-tyranny, whether it's communism or fascism or anything. And I frequently mention how my Croatian grandfather had been a Croatian Nazi prisoner, and I've been speaking out against fascism, and I get my Telegram channel of this podcast and other parts online flooded with these really weird, nasty, pro-Nazi, anti-Semitic, Jew-hating comments. And myself or my audience don't care for that. And it seems to come in waves. So like, yes, for a while it's quiet, and then you have these people starting these conversations between themselves. And I feel like it's the feds trying to create this image to sort of associate us with this, and then use that to take us down. I mean, do you have an insight on how that works? And
there are a lot of real life low-level anti-Semitic trolls, right? And people shouldn't misunderstand what I'm saying here, because I've also been close for years with the more thinking parts of ethno-nationalism in Britain, the Netherlands, and further afield. And we're not afraid of a debate on Jewish issues. We have content on ukcolumn.org that tackles that with a skeptic from within Judaism, who's left Judaism as a religion, Gilad Atzmon, A-T-Z-M-O-N, if you want to look that up on ukcolumn.org using the search function. And just yesterday, a Morg cast with Morgoth's Review, a British nationalist dissident, was also released, in which he asked me about what he calls the Jewish question, and I answered in terms. But there is a lot of real-life, low-level mudslinging going on, semi-literate people who think they know the secret to life, the universe, and everything because they see it's the Jews, right? And they don't like the likes of David Scott and me at UK Column because we can outdo them on Jewish sources, linguistically, historically, archaeologically, theologically, the works. They don't like that. So I've had that too on my Telegram channel. I've had people flinging turds at me. You're a coward. You won't name the Jew. And I repost their comment from the comments under the posts to the main channel, and then I have a pop at them. And that tends to get them to leave fairly quickly because you've got the channel with you then. But not in a Dr. Matthew Sweet way of, oh, how ghastly, anti-Semites everywhere under the bed. No, actually asking them to debate the issues. What you were getting at, Voy, of course, is there official organized trolling? And yes, there is. 77 Brigade, and we now have a whistleblower who's come forward to one of the braver licensed, actually it's not an Ofcom license, but a free media outfit, Big Brother Watch, has confirmed that it was an extremely slapdash operation, with some jumped-up mid-ranking officer going to Britain's cabinet office, which runs the government, the central ministry, and saying, "I can run troll farms and Twitter bots." Although they deny they use bots, but that kind of principle, you know, and it's all completely unlawful. We have articles on UK Column covering that. But 77 Brigade and 13 Signal Regiment of the British Army have been doing that in a very slapdash, lackadaisical way for a while. My assessment is that it's not 77 Brigade type people who turn up saying it's the Jews. That would be distasteful incitement for the likes of them. That kind of thing has happened in the German intelligence services. They, you know, they're as you know, fanatically keen on clamping down on anything they disingenuously call anti-Semitism or Holocaust denial. Yet they are the Western intelligence service par excellence, which do use agent provocateur and use money and agents of influence to provoke their targets into being violent or inciting. So that does happen. But I'm afraid it's just that the underbelly of our free media culture, which is to blame. It's our own in-house trolls, in most cases, 9 out of 10, I would say, who are having a pop at the Jews without any knowledge.
Yeah, I viewed it as both, and it's unfortunate. And so, okay, we've gotten that out of the way. And I wanted to get your big picture view. That's sort of what I try to do on Geopolitics and Empire, unless I bring in an expert on a specific topic. But since it's your first time here, you know, maybe to get your thoughts on geopolitics, globalism and technocracy is what I've been focusing on lately, because I feel like those are the most imminent threats. So, you know, we've got the conflict between East and West, the push for world government, especially via regionalism. Now, I mean, Elon Musk was talking about world government at the World Government Summit this week. Last week, Lula was talking about world government at the White House with Biden. So they're openly more and more discussing it. And we've also got the advance of the biosecurity state, or the algorithm ghetto, as I prefer to call it. And then if there's anything apart from that, you know, that you're personally monitoring, you think is important, please bring it up. But maybe first on geopolitics, the current situation between East and West, you know, we've got the Ukraine war in Europe, which some deem a World War III situation. We've got UFOs over North America and the apparent advancing integration of, you know, the non-Western world and global South via BRICS and other platforms. So geopolitically, what's sort of your take? Are we in the World War III scenario? And what's sort of the real game in your mind when it comes to Ukraine, Russia, US, NATO?
I think it's evident that the Anglo-American establishment for a very long time has had an undue fixation on Ukraine as the navel, the belly button of the Eurasia world island, Eurasia-Africa world island, and a corridor from there really down to Israel, which is the actual knuckle of the three continents where they meet. Control of that corridor, or more particularly Ukraine itself, I think, is something that the British and Americans, particularly the British, have been fixated on in their statecraft for a long time. Whether it's and a kind of inexorable logic that has brought about the Western incitement to this war simply because of that, I think that would be too simplistic to posit. We're getting quite a lot of good intelligence from people within British and Western general international bodies on staff, writing and advising ministers and decision makers and senior officers on policy. And those who obviously find their way to us are the dissidents and the unconvinced of the narrative. And they talk about the glazing over of the eyes of their colleagues and the fanatical marching in lockstep with the narrative. So what's brought us to this from the Western point of view, and equally, if not more so, from the continental Europeans, particularly given the Eastern European states from Croatia, where your roots are from, right up to Estonia and Finland, they're far more fanatical than even the Brits on this front. It's simply this rolling eyes. If you were typing it, you'd use italic font. Everybody knows that Russia wants to rule the world. That is the line that is spun. That is the sum and substance of how the Eastern Europeans have brought the Western European warhawks to this pitch. It's also the sum and substance of how the Western warhawks at, for example, my old employer, GCHQ, managed to persuade their colleagues first and then the foreign ministries and ultimately the governments and the media, that everyone knows that Russia is about to roll over to the English Channel and flatten everything. That's where it's come from. This atavistic tarring of the Russians with this brush, that they're subhuman. I don't consider that the current leadership of the Kremlin is innocuous, is innocent in all this at all. And David Scott, my colleague at UK Column, has put it very well a couple of times, that there's not a better world solution in the offing, you know, coming from Russia or from China. They do have communist hangovers in the case of China, not even such a hangover. We can get hung up on the personality of Putin, whether he's virulently anti-communist or not, but whoever succeeds him is going to have to be at least as hard-nosed, given the way that Russia internally is and the way that the world is arranged against and around Russia at the moment. So it's the vectors are more general than that. There is an inherent logic that's going to push Russia, even though it's an ahistorical thing for Russia to do, more deeply into the arms of China and Iran and other Eurasian allies. Historically, of course, the Russians have very much regarded themselves as a European people and had great skepticism towards other Asian land powers, because they themselves have been expanding eastwards and southwards over the centuries. But I think that the blocks as they are currently drawn are going to persist. Every analyst worth his salt is now trying to do a world map, drawing either two or three colours, usually, of the blocks. Sometimes they regard there being a different block run by the US on the one hand and Europe on the other. Sometimes they split it as the Brits running a block and the Americans running a block. But almost all of them will say that there is a Russo-Chinese block and that that's not going anywhere. Some will call it an authoritarian bloc.
Do you feel, I mean, one of my views is that one of the principal drivers of this conflict is the West attempt to break and balkanize Russia. I mean, they're openly talking about it. You know, what are your other thoughts as to what's driving this?
Yeah. Again, you have to look from East to West, not meaning Russia itself, but if you want to know where the illogical hatred of Russia is, as opposed to the healthy skepticism about, you know, a large and military powerful neighbor, where does the irrational fear of Russia come? You always have to look to the eastern fringe countries first, the Baltic republics, Poland above all, and then Ukraine and the Caucasian republics as well. Poland has always been maybe not the most industrially developed in the whole of Central and Eastern Europe. That would be the Czechs and the Hungarians. But Poland has always taken an intellectual lead in this. And in fact, they have a multi-century history of enmity with the Russians. Of course, they marched in the time of trouble in the early 17th century and took Moscow and nearly snuffed Russia out on the map at one point. But the Poles have got, certainly for a century now, this strong doctrine of breaking Russia up. They have various names for this policy. One was one that's better known as Prometheanism. It was pushed very much during Marshal Pilsudski's interwar government. And the Poles have remained very close to the French and British during and since the Second World War. Obviously, there was the communist interference with that. But the Poles in exile, who then took over the government again, have got this. And as far as I can see now, the tussle between the government and the opposition in very much countries like Poland and its neighbours, the tussle between government and opposition and also between pro and anti-government media is a competition to see who can be more fanatically anti-Russian, who can pin more of the blame for the Smolensk crash on the Russians, for example. This is something that we don't really take account of. More generally, it's been observed that, you know, in the time when James Baker was US Secretary of State and was negotiating with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze for the final settlement at the end of the Cold War, it was very much underestimated by the Americans in particular. Colonel Douglas McGregor has brought out this to light, and he knows the people who were at the table at the time, that it was just assumed that because the Germans had said, ho-hum, we now have a more constrained territory and we have to be good boys, therefore the Poles and the Hungarians and the Romanians would behave likewise and would eschew and forswear what was used to be known as irredentism or revanchism. But of course, this belt of countries, the Croats being another example, I have to say, have not given up these ambitions, and these countries have got, you know, they're rife with folklore, but it goes right up to policymaking level of one day our time will come and it's in the service of mankind and to free the nations held prisoner in the Russian Empire We're going to Tally-ho, the former Polish foreign minister, Anna Fortyga, wrote in Politico very recently, one of the mainstream Brussels titles, saying we will have to break up Russia by forging links with the constituent entities and the and inciting nationalism in the republics. So you know, that it looks so daring to the kind of Anglo-American armchair generals who wish for financial and propaganda reasons to put paid to Russia, that they will take on face value what they're told, whether it's from the Estonian intelligence people saying, we know Ivan's mind better than you guys, or whether it's from the Georgian saying, let us fight a small war on your behalf, or the Ukrainian saying, let us fight a big war on your behalf. The Anglo-Americans, and I'm afraid to say now a lot of the Continentals here in continental Europe, will swallow that hook, line, and sinker. They will believe this stuff.
What's you saw I had recently on Gilbert Doctorow and everyone from Scott Ritter to and many of other folks, Stephen Starr recently, and you know Gilbert was talking about how both sides are testing each other's red lines, and it seems like there is this slow move towards escalation, all sorts of talk of you know hypersonics and tactical mini nukes and whatnot. What sort of your assessment of whether this could escalate into a third world war?
Well, I've said before, I think a couple of times, is it in the interests of any decision makers on either side now to de-escalate? Of course, there will be protestations, particularly from the Russian side, especially from the foreign ministry, which has some honorable people in it in Moscow, that we just want a peaceful coexistence and a mutual respect of national sovereignty and non-interference in internal affairs. But the logic of the system, the expansionist system on both sides, is that they are much more interested in a third world war or an eternal kind of penumbra of the third world war, that the grey zone, the British military strategists and think tanks openly speak about this. Now, we cover it quite extensively on UK Column. They're more interested in that than they are in a return to the Westphalian order and a Christian peace and amity between nations. For one thing, particularly on the Western side, that would cause the economy to go bust much more quickly. There's permanent expansion and gaining of raw materials and collateral that's needed, and you have far better financial and economic experts than I'm able to muster who are making that point. I'm also very interested in the thinking of, I would say he's a dissident even within the truth movement or analytical side of the new media, Joel Skousen in the United States, whom I interviewed in long format once for Insight, our long form one-to-one interview series. For those who don't know, he won't be everyone's cup of tea in our scene because he is skeptical about Russia and whether Russia ever threw off communism. You know, he takes the same line of analysis as Christopher Story, the British analyst, in that regard. And I interviewed Skousen at length about this, and it does make sense to me what he says, that there are world domination-minded elements in Russia and China, very much as there were on both British and German sides in the run-up to both world wars. And they're just wondering now, just as your last guest on Geopolitics and Empire described with these testing of each other's red lines, how far can we push things and when will we be ready for the deep strategic depth we need, the capacity to keep our population with us, keep the propaganda running, keep our raw materials and industrial heavy industrial production going, have enough manpower to draw on. These continue calculations are being made. Skousen has made a habit of this, and he's got a good background with the US Marine Corps and survivalism and good contact in Washington to calculate it. And if you philosophically accept his premises, then his conclusions, I would say, are fairly sound, which is that the Russo-Chinese bloc believes that it will be ready to take on the collective West, as they now call us, by the latter half of this decade. And we're now hearing US fairly senior officers openly opining about that, aren't we? That sometime around 2025 there'll be a war with China. Not an existential war, at least that's not what's being said into thinking out loud. Probably a war over Taiwan. But Skousen, you know, goes the whole hog with this and says they would actually wish to take us over, not to obliterate us, quite the opposite, but to run our intact cities and infrastructure for their own gain so that they are top dog in a new world order.
Yeah, I've got Christopher Story's books. I read them like 15 years ago. They're in a box somewhere in my home in Croatia. I was looking them over last year when I was there. And yeah, I've had Jeff Nyquist on, who's also of, I think, Joel Skousen's view. And I also entertain what you just laid out. I keep these things open as scenarios, and then I'll just pull the file depending on how we see things developing. You know, maybe we'll start seeing things develop in the way Skousen has talked about. And I'm like, well, then, you know, he's onto something. And that sort of brings me then to the next topic of world control that we're talking about, you know, globalism, world government. As I mentioned, Lula last week was with Biden in the White House openly saying we need world governance. We need global governance. That's just, you know, it's world government. And he was saying that we need to force all nations to obey our world governance. And then Elon Musk came out this week sort of poo-pooing this idea. But I've been noticing a trend last fall in September, October. One of my three presidents, AMLO, the Mexican president, and people can find the actual transcript where he actually said this. He said something to the tune of that the EU that... first of all, just to mention, people can go back in 2016, AMLO tweeted an image with him and his buddy Jeremy Corbyn, and on that tweet, they openly said they're working towards world government. Literally, he said that. And so in September, AMLO was saying that we want to copy the EU in North America and integrate Canada, USA, and Mexico. A few weeks later, we get ex-Ecuador president Rafael Correa saying, we want to copy the EU in South America. Yes. Lula is saying, let's create a common currency. You've got the Middle East Union, you know, maybe the Abraham Accords are the genesis of that. You've got the African Union already exists. And as you were talking about already, Eurasian Union is basically, it's like they're all copying the EU, which is the blueprint.
Although East Asia and Southeast Asia, I know they have ASEAN, but East Asia, north of that in particular, is going to be the hardest, isn't it, to regionalize. Getting the Chinese, the Japanese, and Koreans to share a currency and have a shared international supranational bureaucracy is going to be a pretty tall order.
Yeah, what's sort of then your general view on this idea of world government, how advanced we are, and any other thoughts you have on it?
Again, you have to posit the other way around, don't you? You have to ask, in which capitals of non-negligible countries in the world is there a line of thinking and the training of the next generation of diplomats and think tank people to endorse with robustness continued national sovereignty? Now, some people might put their hopes in the Eurasian bloc in this regard because they call for the rule of law through the UN, particularly the Security Council. But they too are looking at alternative transnational currencies. They are, as we are unable to ignore anymore, very keen on digital ID, as keen, if not more so, than some of the European countries. And that is not loose. That's not separate from what we're discussing, because part of the idea of digital ID is that it's a return to medieval feudalism, that you might want to roam, but you're still, as it were, branded. Everyone knows whose property you are and where you pay taxes, to whom you pay taxes. So you've got no liberty by moving over across the border as medieval Europeans did to escape a tyrant in one area. I don't see that there's any corner of the world, with the possible exception of some of the more expressly Christian countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where there is a whole class of administrators of the current and in-training generation that wish for a continuation of national sovereignty unabated, uncurtailed. Everywhere else, the whole of Latin America, from what I can see as a non-expert in Hispanic matters, is beset not just by the perennial problem of statism and socialism that comes and goes in waves across Latin America, but more particularly with this idea of forming a block of solidarity. And the further east you go in Eurasia, the world island in Alfred Mackinder's terms, the pricklier people get, because of course Europe and Africa consist of several rather artificial states. There's no real sentiment of that towards the east of Asia. Even in multi-ethnic India, with hundreds of nationalities, there is this strong sense that India is a state, and you can't break that up. And that persists as you go further east. So the egos there are going to be more difficult to bring into line. But in the end, I think if you want a resistance to it, you're going to have a doctrine underpinning it. So it'll be the fight of our generation, philosophically, militarily, and in every other way, to get our children and those who govern our children out of that mindset or prevent them from falling into it in the first place. But where is the where is the alternative philosophy going to come from? The return to the previous philosophy in the countries that pushed globalism the hardest, like Britain, by the Edwardian era, over 100 years ago now, there was no serious game in town other than ultimately that there would be world government. The only disagreement between these questionable gentlemen was whether Britain would rule the whole lot or only those parts of it that could be anglicised. That was an issue that was in revolving around Lord Lothian and the Round Table movement. Other than that, the West is completely finished, as far as I can see, in leading the way in souverainist thinking. So that there is going to be, by hook or by crook, world government unless we do something about it, and more particularly unless we, the free-thinking people of the world, train the next generation in how to govern states.
So for those listeners out there that always ask me, where's a place that you can escape to? There you go, Africa, some parts of Africa. And do you feel world government is at some point inevitable?
People get what they deserve, and they also get what they pay for. And people, it's been well recognized in statecraft and in religion for millennia that people get the priests and the government that reflect their own values and what they are prepared to put up with. There are certain countries in the world where people are so prepared to be abused that they're almost guilty of the crimes that are perpetrated against them. I won't name any now, but it strikes me on reading world history that that's the case. Others are perhaps too much the other way and will not even knuckle under and live peaceably under a lawful government because they're so individualistic. But the trend of the world thinking there is a global culture now formed by media and ultimately greed, selfish desires, the fulfillment of lusts of various kinds, which is now given free rein and license in various civilized parts of society around the world, that is causing this drift. People do not want to be responsible for their own freedoms. You have to tackle this at root, really. Like, you know, anyone can call themselves a geopolitical analyst, and I'm sure you and I can come up with examples of the less than brilliant who just, you know, think that they can name a few statistics and call themselves a geopolitician. No, if you are taking the matter seriously, you have to begin with the nature of the people, the terrain and the climate of a nation, its strategic interests, and also the evolution over time of a people. Also collectively, at world level over time, what people's primary desires are, where they sit in Maslow's pyramid of hierarchies. And in all of these ways, Hrvoje, I'm afraid to say that the trend is towards world government because people would rather, in the main, be told what to do and are content to live, you know, the way they are. I'm now hearing very strong arguments from people that, you know, despite the general collapse that's prophesied or foretold in various ways, we will somehow have at least an industrial level, if not an electronic era, civilization coming out the other end, which, interestingly enough, is what all the sci-fi masters predict for millennia ahead as well, even if there's chaos and mayhem in the middle. Because once people have tasted that and have that in their collective memory, they do not want to go back to autarky. You know, I very much admire small holdings and self-sufficiency. You know, in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, we've still got crofters who are some of the most admirable people in the whole United Kingdom and some of the most resistant to every kind of globalism and filth that comes our way. But if you didn't grow up in that system, or if you don't have a very strong personal determination, it will not be on your horizon as within the envelope of possible lifestyles. And that envelope is being pushed and compressed and also elongated and moved along towards living in a de facto an urban environment, even if what, you know, if you live in what in the West now is nowadays called a village, it's like being in a city because of the way you're wired and the way you live inside and don't produce your own food. And that's what people are going to think of as the possible way in which to live. And if you're within that mind frame, then you can very easily be nudged again and again, however many setbacks there are for globalism, you will continually be nudged back to that point.
Yeah, and I've noticed the same trend as you, just having been in Europe and then talking to Canadians and Americans, even here in Mexico, most people, I've had Americans openly tell me to my face that they just want like money and security, and they prefer stronger government to freedom and liberty. And it's going as you say, and I think it's been this mind control through the internet, which is a weapon. I think all of this stuff is this military weapons. You know, Facebook was DARPA project. Google was, if you ask me, seed funded by Pentagon, internet, GPS, and so these are all weapons against us. And I'm just curious on Britain, because Britain has left the EU, where they would fit. And I saw, I think a year or two ago, Britain showed interest in wanting to join NAFTA or NAFTA 2.0 USMCA, which is basically the North American Union. And I recall from reading, I think 1939, there was this globalist plan called the Atlantic Union, which was, they were talking about forming this supranational Atlantic Union, which would include Britain, Canada, and US. And so it's just kind of interesting to see Britain leave EU now. And so where are they going to be placed? I mean, do you have any thoughts on the future of Britain?
Many, because of course that features in every episode of UK Column News. But to boil it down, what I would say is we have a class of dreamers running us, the think tanks and the politicians and the bureaucrats, who regard Britain, the island, as far too petty, too circumscribed to do justice to their glorious, vainglorious ambitions. So Britain is a pawn for them. So from the start, the whole of our governing class, regardless of political party or profession, went overnight from our identity is steering Europe to our identity is the Commonwealth, or more particularly the Five Eyes. Now we see the AUKUS, Australia, UK, US alliance being talked up. The Australians may be about to receive nuclear submarines. This goes back to the thinking around 1960, just before Britain's accession to what was then the EEC, when Britain openly called its holdings and its interests in Southeast Asia and along the Indian Ocean coast up to Suez Canal, called that the Fourth Empire. That was why our the best plane project that was aborted by the globalists, the TSR-2, was brought about, so that Britain could do these hops right the way down the chain to Australia and run an empire then. There, some of the sharpest Russian analysts still think of Britain's particular sphere of interest as being but what we call east of Suez, the area from which the Royal Navy and the colonialists famously withdrew, and Britain a couple of years ago, because of Brexit, said, well, we're back now. It's all faux. It's all fake, because we don't have the military muscle or the know-how or the engineering or the self-respect or the morals to do any of that empire building. But we like to be seen. Our governing class like to be seen projecting themselves there. And likewise, we like to think that we can still steer the Americans and lay claim to their vast resources, above all their human resources, as part of our project. So that's a sickness which we're going to have for a very long time, if not forever, in what remains of Britain as a state, that its governing class is going to think, well, we're here to run the world, or a substantial slice of it. And along with that goes, we are here to use Johnny Foreigner to fight the latest enemy, often the Russians, but before that, of course, the Germans.
Yeah, I mean, this is just fascinating for me. And maybe to jump to then the biosecurity regime, which more and more, I'm looking at it as a, COVID having been a military intelligence operation in conjunction with big pharma, with media, international institutions, which have overpowered national governments. And I had some military guy actually tweet yesterday. He dug up a tweet of mine from February 2nd, 2020, based on my interview with Dr. Francis Boyle discussing this stuff and saying geopolitics and empire was right way back then. And my biggest fear is the whole cashless digital passport scheme, and which, they'd established this social credit system in every single country where if you don't behave, they literally just could shut you off from life. You couldn't buy food. You couldn't work. You couldn't travel. You couldn't do anything. You'd basically be left to starve to death in your home. And how do you see the whole COVID pandemic biosecurity regime?
Well, Britain, again, leads the way in nefariousness here, Pavoya, because we no longer have a public health agency. The UK is four countries for the purposes of health. Each of the home nations has its own national health service, operating under its own brand. But NHS England is no longer partnered with a Public Health England. You still have something called Health Scotland and so on. But Public Health England at the beginning of the COVID era, merged with various other bodies to form what they now call the UK Health Security Agency. An interview which has just gone up today by our nursing correspondent, Debbie Evans, with a knowledgeable lady called Cheryl Granger, has an interesting moment. If you listen to this fresh, you'll find it on the homepage. Otherwise, you can search for it. Because Cheryl Granger, with tongue in cheek, calls this UK HSA the NHS Security Office or something of that nature. The NHS Security Service is almost her words, not exactly, but that's the way things are going. The population, starting again in Britain with its unique model of the NHS from 1948, which is, you know, the government, the taxpayer, being the health insurer and the only one available in practice. That model from the start regarded the population as the asset. You are the product. The clients are the pharmaceuticals and the mind benders. You are the product, not the client. And as part of that model, you're going to want to know the vital statistics and particulars of everyone. That the sharp end of it is really through the campaigning of our nursing correspondent, Debbie Evans, and those like-minded with her, because when they ask the pressing questions, can I opt out of the NHS? Can I retrieve from you my NHS medical notes and will you destroy your own copy? No, no, ma'am, we will not. Those are owned by us forever and we will sell them to anyone we want. Right, that makes it more brutally obvious what's going on than in most other countries where there is either, well, pre-Obamacare, minimal government involvement in health insurance in the US, or in the European or Latin American model, a mixed so-called Bismarckian model where there's a layer between the health ministry and the public. Namely, you have some choice in which of these mutuals, often employer-based or religious or philosophical, is the one that you prefer that will hold your pot of money. In those systems, it's more disguised and it's taking longer to roll over. But Britain, and I think Canada to some extent, have got this going direct model where the population is the asset. So biosecurity is key. I've never forgotten Catherine Austin Fitz's insights into the parallels between late Roman Empire and Greek Empire slavery, early modern Anglo-American slavery of the Africans, and indeed many Irish, which is forgotten, and British dissidents went off to slavery in Virginia. And what's happening now? The key, if you are such an amoral psychopathic type that you can think this way, and we're helped by the analysis of Catherine Austin Fitz and others to do that, then slavery is profitable as long as you can keep people on your reservation. You can do that once again in a globalized society as long as you either physically or digitally prevent people from going off beyond where they can be seen. Because that person is the asset. You stamp their body, or in these days you take their biometrics, their DNA or their iris or whatever, in order to say, well, you might end up in Tahiti, but you're still mine. Right? And the only way out at that point is to say, I'm not going to participate in this system. Now, I'm not a radical purist in this regard. I knew even when I moved here to the Netherlands in 2009 that even then they had digital identity. Because the Dutch are very naive and trusting in this regard and want an easy life. So together with a few vaguely Teutonic countries, they even at that stage were saying, we have digital ID. It's called DigiD or DigiD in Dutch. They don't make any bones about it. And it's only for filing your tax returns for convenience at this stage. But it's, as far as I know, mandatory for the nice to haves. So every teenager, I was talking to one in our church last night who's just going for her scooter license. And the only way to get one is to apply for one of these DigiDs. You're just a new adult. And the first thing you do is say, dear government, please take my digital identity so that I can do my driving test. Right. So you need massive resolve at that stage in life to say no. Because that means you're going to be requiring public transport or paid cab hires for the rest of your life for transport. So that's the way the Dutch have arranged it. I can just about live with that because that's not a daily use. But you have to draw a line in the sand, as many people in the movement are saying now, that if you are required to use digital identity to pay for things, then you say, and this will only work if you mean it, if you've searched through your soul and come to this conclusion, that you say to those requiring that of you, no, I'm prepared to starve to death, but I'm not prepared to get your digital identity. Right? Because at the critical mass, most of us who say that will not actually starve to death, if any. We'll very quickly find ways to survive and thrive outside that system.
Yeah, that brings me to another question that we often broach on the podcast in this coming algorithm ghetto, how to survive. And, you know, people talk about building parallel structures, parallel societies, parallel economies. Do you feel like this is what's going to happen, that we're just going to have two worlds existing, and those of us that say no to that will be surviving in a parallel structure? Yes. Or is that?
Yes, and we have precedent for this, particularly, I think, in the early centuries of the Christian Church. There was the then technological equivalent of digital identity, which is what's described in prophetic terms as the mark of the beast in Revelation, in that there was a long time where, you know, you had to use what Christians regarded as idolatrous money in order to buy things. And there were a number of people who were not prepared on principle to use that money. And instead of sitting and piously praying until they wasted away, they engaged in, and people might be shocked to hear me describe it this bluntly, but it's black marketeering in order to survive and thrive. Dr. Phil Kaiser, that's K-A-Y-S-E-R, over in Omaha, Nebraska, is one of the foremost Christian preachers on this theme. He's done a very long service. It's a sermon series on Revelation that talks about this. Phil Kaiser is easily found. He's got his own website. And he's done chapter and verse on this, that there were centuries of the late Roman Empire where not just Christians as either, as far as I'm concerned, but as far as I'm aware, but dissidents of all stripes said, well, we are going to live more simply this way, and we're going to, some of us will fall, we'll be imprisoned or tortured or killed, but we are going to survive as a mass this way, because the alternative is to have our souls stolen from us at the point of sale. All of these systems revolve around point of sale, right? Everything else is out of question. So if you can find a way of bartering, and I'm not saying only you need to find only one of these, but a combination according to time, place, circumstance, anything that avoids point of sale being the official, you know, the mainstream point of sale, will obviate this requirement.
I recall doing some research, you know, during the whole pandemic with these COVID passes, and then I have right behind me, I bought from an Italian antique dealer on eBay for $10 this 1938 Nazi sort of health pass, which they used in Nazi Germany to prove your biological purity, your Aryanism. And then separately, you have the actual Nazi health pass. And then just as you're saying, I was shocked to discover in the Roman times, they also had some sort of certificate kind of like this, where it was a certificate, I guess, Romans were required to have, where you were forced to sacrifice an animal to the pagan gods.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have the certificate, you have to, I don't know, be fined or jailed or killed. And many Christians at the time got these fake pagan certificates, or did what you were talking about. And then I lost the bookmark, but I had the actual primary source from 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages during the whole Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church, which had a similar, like all throughout this time, there has existed this sort of certificate control mark of the beast system. And in the Holy Roman Empire, they actually said, if you don't ideologically submit to the Holy Roman Empire, you know, spiritually, philosophically, morally, you won't be able to buy or sell. Like, you also had to have a certificate.
This goes back way, way, way back to Bronze Age tyranny, Srivoya. You had to worship your petty local king and his overlord, great king, as God on earth. You know, that goes to as far back, if you take the conventional view of archaeology, to urbanization, you know, to ultimately to what the anthropologist would call the period of speciation. You know, that's as soon as we start to live together, top dog in local society demands that you worship him and praise him for his munificence. There've always been people who've skirted around that, but that's the way that human societies are organized. And so, you know, self-sufficiency time and again in history in many societies has been at the preserve of those who have struck out physically or at least intellectually from that and said, we are not prepared to.
Since we've delved a bit into the spiritual, and I've had in the past guests like Canadian pastor Arthur Pawlowski and Patrick Woods of Technocracy, who are also Christians, and they both were of the same opinion that you know, just regarding prophecy, you know, there's this, I think at some point history ends, but I kind of view of all these things that we're talking about, like they progress over time and get worse and worse. And, you know, Pawlowski and Pat Wood were saying that it's like successive waves. Like World War II was one moment where there was this attempt to take over the planet. It failed for whatever reason, maybe divine intervention or people resisting this evil. And then we had decades of freedom and prosperity, and it seems like it's back again, in more force. And then the question is whether it'll establish itself now or we'll throw it off and then we'll have more, you know, decades of freedom and prosperity. How do you sort of view spiritually or prophetically the times that we're in?
The concept of time in the Bible, which is something I often teach when I teach biblical languages to people of various nationalities as well, is very important. We often hear this tussle in the postmodern era between those who say that time as a linear concept is Eurocentric and old hat, and we should go back to this cyclical view of time, right? It's been that what's been before will come again. Such sentiments are mentioned in the Bible as well by Solomon in Ecclesiastes, but he doesn't mean to say that it's some kind of eternal yuga cycle, as in Hinduism. The best summary I could give of what the biblical view of time and prophecy is that you're a downward spiral. It's the opposite of climbing a mountain. So you keep seeing the same thing from a different vantage point. In Revelation, you could say that you're climbing a mountain, coming up higher, and every time you do a circuit, you have the same view of the same point that came earlier in the book, but from a higher angle. But the time is on Earth among sinful man is the opposite of that. It's a downward spiral. It comes to a point at rock bottom when God cuts it off with the return of Christ. But you will see the same things coming again and again, only worse, you know, baser than ever before. The delay between something being invented and it being used for wickedness rather than for good is now extremely short. That's, I think, the underlying reality that we face, so that we are always going to have more intense tyrannies than before that want to get into your biometric data, into your head, read your mind. They're talking about it. You know, it's not conspiracy theory anymore. But the question is, you know, when does God intervene? Well, Christ has a rhetorical question, doesn't he, at the end of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. But when the Son of Man comes, returns, will he find faith on the earth? He doesn't say yes or no. He leaves it as a challenging question. The Apostle Paul says that evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving themselves and being deceived. That, I think, is my proof text in the New Testament that you are going to see repeats of the same thing going on and on.
That's a great way that you put it, and I agree with what you said, and just a new way of thinking for me, and I'll be digging into that. And we've covered a lot. I think people are going to like this talk. Is there any thoughts on what we do given everything that we sort of covered? War, the spiritual aspect, the technological tyranny. How do we approach this as people from around the world? You know, my view is just to always resist evil and tyranny. It's our duty. And then, you know, we talked about parallel societies. You know, any other thoughts on what do we do as a people to resist?
Simplify and practice. Those two verbs cover it. Simplify your life as much as possible, even getting rid of clutter. And I don't mean things that could help you survive in tough times, but clutter that takes up your time and attention and space. The same emotionally. Live the simplest you can and enjoy your meals, your time with people much more than ever before. You will recharge far more deeply that way. You will sleep better. And practice. Practice saying no. You know, one of the many definitions we give of UK Column is that it helps people, gives them the ammunition to say no. But, you know, we are the Haynes manual, or one of the Haynes manuals of saying no, but that's no good on its own. You also need to be getting on the shooting range, metaphorically speaking, I hasten to add, and getting in the hours, building up the mileage of saying no. So you start small and locally by saying no to petty tyranny. You do so as calmly as you can, with an uncluttered mind. And you will find like-minded people along the way, you know, and just by saying, I don't go along with this, you get such peace of mind, and you meet soulmates that way. But that's all the preparation. Well, that's not all the preparation you need to do. Some people, depending on their temperament, will feel very convicted that they should start a small holding and store food. Who am I to gainsay them? It's not my way. I think there's, at the very least, enough evidence in the New Testament that biblical Christians don't have to be that way, that they can also say, I'll be carrying on with my ministries as before until the Lord sees fit to take me. That's equally valid. But the common denominator between those two or three liberty-loving approaches is that you do practice saying no.
Yeah, that's minimalism. You know, something that I try to practice, and I've told people the form of minimalism, and there's this movement today, but I always just intuitively viewed the biblical Christian way as they were minimalist. They didn't have much, and I was
right there in the New Testament, my brethren, having to have not many of these world's goods.
Yeah, and it's less, you know, mentally less things to think about, and so any final thought for us?
Well, I think we've said it all, really, for an introductory podcast. It does come to mind that if you or anyone else among the listeners would like to check out Dr. Phil Keyser, I do rate him very highly on a number of fronts for his insights on Revelation, other parts of the Bible, for his work in forging spiritual links between East and West. He's been in St. Petersburg very often with like-minded people. If I'm not wrong, his website is Keyser, that's K-A-Y-S-E-R, keysercommentary.com. You'll find a wealth of material there. He's also on sermonaudio.com. No, just comes to mind because you personally said that you were interested in looking at this further. I'm not, you know, here to bring in, you know, dissension between people on their various schools of prophecy and when the millennium occurs and so on, but at least start with a historic starting point of how this church historically understood these matters and how they got through the worst of the struggle in a previous iteration of it.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out. And where are the best places to find you on the internet?
ukcolumn.org, and I run a Telegram channel in my own right, which is called Eastern Approaches. That's t.me/eastapp.
I'll include all of those links in the description. I do follow your Telegram, and it's been great having you on the program. Thank you for being with me, Alex.
A pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.